we'll go ahead and get started. And I sent you some questions about, you know, the place of safety. And the reason I chose the place of safety is because it was one of the suggestions that was made as far as things, topics to cover. And we'll see how we go with this one. Maybe we'll get through it, but maybe not. We'll do our best. Some of it may be based upon input. So we'll try to, as we go through this, we'll try to answer the questions that I sent out about, is there a place of safety? And so we'll kind of get to some of those questions, maybe not in the order that I laid them out, but we will get to them and try to lay everything out and answer all of them. So as you think about the subject of the place of safety, and you look at that particular subject, one of the things that's interesting in the time in which we live is you have, you know, especially in our country, you have people seeking to cross the border all the time. And you have people coming from especially Mexico and from Central America. And then you've seen all these pictures probably of all these people in a, you know, huge numbers walking along the road into various parts of Europe. And the world at this particular time, it has a serious problem with people's lives being disrupted by warfare and all of that. And so you have these people that are refugees, and they're all seeking a place of refuge. They're all seeking a place of safety to one extent or another. I mean, you look at what's taken place in Syria, where you've got a civil war going on. People's lives have been disrupted, and they've been forced from their homes. And sometimes the government's played a part in that in disrupting things. And so people are looking for a place to go. And Europe is a, you know, Europe's got to be better than being on the road in Syria or Turkey. And so they're trying to get there. So we see this in our world today. You also see the situation with the, you know, our world is very disrupted. You know, we've got the coronavirus. We've got our economy disrupted. We've got people that are sick, and it's really quite a world we live in at this particular time. Something that none of us have ever experienced. Did any of you ever live through the Great Depression? Your parents probably did. My parents did, and so they gave us stories of at least, and my grandmother gave me stories of what was going on then. It was not a pleasant world. Life was hard, and many of us at least had parents who went through the Great Depression. And
Somebody is.
These are the seven names that have been declassified, and this includes Vice President Biden.
I don't know who that is.
It's getting on.
Yeah.
Sorry, somebody was not muted.
So anyway, moving on, as you look at the world today, you have 68 million people who are, based upon the records I found online, that are supposedly refugees. Half of them are children. That's an amazing number of people that are displaced and looking for a place to settle and live. And so we've got, it's an amazing situation we live in. And as I said, a place of safety would also be known as a place of refuge. Now, if you're looking at the scriptures, where does it talk about the need for a place of safety, where there would be a possibility of becoming refugees? What can you think of any scriptures where that would be the case, where you would have to be seeking a place in order to be protected and watched over because of things going on in the world that are a threat? So God has pointed that out. Let's go to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21 talks about refugees and what may come upon the church and has happened to the church at various times.
Okay, go ahead.
So, did I say that?
Yeah, you said the only one at the...
Okay, so anyway, let's go to Luke 21, verse 10. It says, and this is in chapter 21, and just like chapter 24, which talks about the end of the age and various things that will be happening at that particular time. So it says here, then he said to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes in various places and famines and pestilences, and there will be fearful sights and great signs in heaven. And as you think about what that's saying, we at this particular time, we have warfare going on, nation against nation, in the Middle East anyway, and we have kingdom against kingdom, and there have been earthquakes, and you also see talking about the famines and pestilences. We're having, that's going on right now, it is a serious thing. We haven't reached the end. I don't think what's going on is the end, but it says like at the end of verse 11, it says, there will be fearful sights and great signs from heaven. Fearful sights and great sights from heaven. And when will that be? Great signs from heaven. And, you know, you're looking at that's all going to take place at the end. And, you know, where you find out about the fearful signs in heaven, it's one of the last events to occur, which is mentioned in the book of Revelation. Let's go to Luke chapter 21, verse 12. It says, before all these things, before all of this plays out, it says, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and prisons. You will be brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. So, this is what Christ is telling his disciples before he actually, his life came to a close. And he's saying that, you know, when it talks about synagogues here, you're talking about the religious authorities are going to take action against you, and they're going to put you in prison. You're going to be brought before kings and rulers. And he said that this is all something that, we should expect as God's people. And we're getting closer to the end of the age. It says in verse 13, but it will turn out for you as an occasion of testimony. So what does that mean? It's going to turn out as an occasion for testimony. So if you're arrested and they ask you about your beliefs or what you're doing or why you're doing it, that's where you're going to have the opportunity to have to explain yourself, what you believe and why you believe it. And that's, and like one of the, you know, if you're doing the Bible, writing program, one of the memory scripture this time talks about sanctify the God in your heart and be ready to give an answer of the hope that's within you. So that's something we're not going to get, you know, if we're there before the authorities, they're putting the pressure on and demanding what we believe and why we believe it. We're not going to be able to come up with that on the fly. Most of us aren't going to be able to do that. But if you know what you believe and why you believe it and somebody asks you about it, then you can explain it. Now they may not be happy with what you have to say, but you can explain it, and we should be able to explain it. There's a hope within us. There's a hope that we're striving for, and we need to be ready to give an answer, because that time when we're all going to be questioned about it is coming. And I would say it behooves us to start preparing now. It says in verse 14, this is interesting, therefore settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer. So don't be worrying about what you're going to answer beforehand. That doesn't mean you don't prepare, but it means that you can't think of all of the ways you're going to be challenged. So when you're there sitting before them, you may be challenged, and that's when God will help you to draw upon the resources that you've developed already. Your understanding of God's way of life, your understanding of the law and the truths that we believe in. Why do you keep the holy days? Why do you meet on Sabbath? Why do you do the things that you do? And that way you can answer them, and answer them sensibly, and they may not be happy with your answers, but you still can answer. Verse 15 says, "For I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist." So God will be with us. God will guide our tongue, and he will give us wisdom so that we can answer our adversaries. Now, as you answer them, you look at the Apostle Paul. I think the Apostle Paul answered his adversaries quite well. Same thing with Stephen. But Paul survived a number of different situations where he was taken prisoner and questioned. Stephen didn't get too many opportunities. So he answered, and they didn't like what he had to say, and he was put to death. And that's going to be a very challenging time for all of us. It says in verse 16, "You will be betrayed even by parents and brothers, relatives and friends." And they will be put to death. So some our relatives probably, and some of our neighbors probably know what we believe, and some of them may be thinking that they're doing God a service in order to turn us in. I know people are pretty sometimes pretty quick to turn other people in.
Coronavirus.
Yeah, well, if you look at people who are not who are not taking measures against coronavirus, you have your neighbors turning you in, and that's not a good condition to be in, but that's the time that we live in. He says, goes on to say, "And you will be hated for all, by all for my name's sake. And but not a hair of your head shall be lost." Now, when it says that we're going to be hated by everyone for my name's sake, that's pretty amazing. How many of us have experienced that condition where we're hated by our friend or by our neighbors and others? I don't think many of us have experienced that. But so anyway, we have to. Try to understand that it could be very interesting what's coming on, and but not a hair of your head shall be lost, and by your patience possess you your souls. But I don't think that's necessarily saying you won't die. You know, you won't be a martyr. And so you need God's wisdom to answer. You need God's wisdom in order to address any challenges that we face. As you go to, let's go over to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24 and look at verse 7. Matthew 24, verse 7. And in Matthew verse 7 of Matthew 24 explains the various wars and famines and different things that have happened throughout history, and they're going to continue to happen, but they're going to intensify as we come to the end of the age. And for verse 7 of Matthew 24 says, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places." And verse 8 says, "All these are the beginning of sorrows." So that's not the end point. Those are the beginning of sorrows, things that will be going on in the world around us that are going to be unsettling and create a great deal of uncertainty. And then verse 9, it turns serious. It says, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. And you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake." Again, this goes along with Luke 21. We'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Because we believe in and we follow Jesus Christ, we're going to be hated. This is not something that will never happen. This is something to, that's to come at the end of the age. And sometimes it, God's people have faced this, as we'll see at various times. Verse 9 says, they will deliver you up to tribulation. And then verse 10, it says, and then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. So sadly, because of what we believe and what we practice, some will be offended. Some will be offended at that, and they're going to betray us and God's people. It's going to be an interesting time, and how close we are to all of that unfolding, I don't know. It's what Christ is doing is saying, this is what's coming. And the apostles went through it to a degree in their time, but this is pointing toward the end of the age, and God's people have periodically faced these kinds of challenges. Verse 11 says, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And all of this has happened historically, and it's prophesied to happen again. And as you look at what's to unfold, there's going to be false prophets who will be deceiving many. Verse 12 says, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. And we're moving toward a lawless world, a world where God's law doesn't mean much, and less people are familiar with the Bible and God's instructions about how to live and how to treat other people. And so we're moving toward that time. And then the crucial statement in verse 13 of Matthew 24, it says, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. And interestingly, that's not the best translation. A better translation is, he who endures right through it all. He who endures right through it all. Or another way you could say it, or he who endures no matter what happens will be saved. So we have to endure no matter what happens, and there are going to be some surprises. I mean, how many of us expected what we're dealing with now? None of us did. None of us did. And we're not just supposed to hang on to the end of the rope, hanging there just for dear life. We're to actually function in life, even though we're having to endure things. We endure it in the most positive way we can. It's like with the coronavirus, we try to endure it the best way we can. We can't get out. We can't, we're restricted, but try to make the most of it. And I think most of us have tried to do that. Then Christ goes on to talk about the preaching of the gospel. That will take place right up to the very end. We've sought to preach the gospel. We continue to try to preach the gospel. And it tells us that this is going to happen right on up to the end of the age. It's going to be carried out, and then the end will come. And, I'm not sure exactly how that will take place, but it is going to take place. God said he's going to, and will it be the two witnesses that will do it? I don't know. We'll find out as it all unfolds. Chapter 24, verse 15 says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. And Christ is the one who says, whoever reads, let him understand. So when we see something that fits with what Daniel says in his writing about the abomination of desolation, then we realize that the end is near. And he says that that abomination will come that makes desolate. And Christ added, whoever reads this, let him understand. And that's all of us. Do we understand what it means? So as something appears on the scene like the abomination of desolation, then we know that the end is near. Verse 16, it says, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So these people in Judea will be fleeing to the mountains because of the abomination of desolation and everything that goes with it. And so they're going to flee for their lives. They're going to be looking for a place where they can hide, a place where they can escape the threat that's being made against them. And so this is directly speaking to a time when people are going to be refugees, and they're going to be looking for a place to hide, a place to where they can be safe. And you know, that what we saw taking place with people from Syria may be us. We're going to have to people. It may not just be us in the church, but others that are being driven out of their homes or persecuted in some way, and they're going to have to flee for their lives. So this happened back in the past, that, and Christ mentioned it, but Christ is also mentioning this and pointing to the future. So, interesting to consider, and we'll see how it plays out. And as you think about it, what he goes on to say here, he says, let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. So when you see the abomination of desolation and the threat is real, it says you need to get out of town quickly. You need to get out of town quickly and get away from wherever you're living. And don't go try to gather more things up. You know, if you don't have your go bag ready to go, then you better just take off with what you've got. And it says in verse 24, verse 18, Matthew 24, verse 18, it says, but let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. So this is going to come, it seems like it's going to come on all of a sudden. And people are going to be forced from their homes and forced from their fields, and they're going to have to do it all quickly. And then verse 19 says, but woe to those who are pregnant. You know, if you're pregnant, do you want to be making a run for it? And those who are nursing babies in those days, I don't think any mothers that are pregnant or women who are pregnant or nursing babies want to be fleeing for their lives. And that is especially applicable in our church area at this point. We've got a lot of babies that have been born. So we've got nursing babies, and I think, you know, this would greatly resonate with people that are facing that kind of a condition. So as you look at Matthew chapter 24, let's look at verse 20 and 21. It says, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. You know, we don't want to be fleeing in the winter. Winters may be a little bit milder, but you know, we don't want it to be on the Sabbath either. But we aren't going to be able to choose the time. It says, for then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. So it's talking about the great tribulation. And we know that that particular prophecy ties in with the book of Revelation and the great tribulation of that is spoken of there. It's something that is going to unfold. God says this is going to happen, so it will. And so this is going to be a very serious time for you and me. And it's so serious, we know that if God did not intervene, there would be no flesh saved alive. That God is going to watch what I do. So anyway, let's hear Michelle Machen.
Got to unmute. Traditionally, the church taught that Petra was going to be the place of safety. About the time I was at Ambassador College in the late 70s, they told us that we were going to shelter in place and we wouldn't flee to the place of safety.
Here we are. We're already sheltering in place.
Exactly. We were told that God could protect us wherever we were around the world. Not that I don't think that he can, but I think that scripture shows us there will be a flight. From the scriptures that give us clues about the place, the church settled on Petra. I don't know. We're not the only ones who decided on Petra. Other churches have also garnered that from scripture. I guess I have to say that I decided I would let God decide and I wasn't going to worry about it. I would just go where he said to
go. Probably wise. So, Rich Schultz?
Yes, I was going to back up what Michelle had stated. I remember those three-hour discussions by Gerald Waterhouse. I think a lot of us remember those. And it got to be very detailed, which was probably more speculative. Try to be very encouraging about it. However, I've heard the converse, like you say, staying in place. And but I wonder how this all ties in with the punishment of our country and how people are going to be taken away as slaves. I would assume that we would be spared from that, because if we're sitting in our own homes they're rounding up people in the United States and taking them away and spreading them to the four corners of the earth, why would they not come to our house unless God put some type of special protection over your house?
Well, be a good point. Richard Robbins?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I think one of the things that we traditionally taught was from Revelation 12 and verse 14. And that says to the woman or the church, we're given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time, times and a half time from the face of the serpent. And because of the wording of the word place in the singular, we always taught that it would be a place, not places.
That's true. So just some things about that. You know, one thing that's for sure is God can protect us. God has protected his people at various times throughout history. You know, as you look at the Noachian flood, the whole world's wiped out, and God selected eight people and the animals that he wanted to, and the various creatures that he wanted to preserve, and made sure that they were saved through the flood. And God has protected his people at various times throughout history. You know, during the time of Ahab, you had all those people they were searching for, and they were protected. So God is able and willing to protect us, and he can protect us not just, you know, wherever we happen to be at. Did God protect Israel when they were leaving Egypt? Absolutely. God was with them every step of the way, and he watched over them, and he protected them. And when the Egyptian army got close, what did God do? God intervened and cut off the Egyptian army from being able to attack them right away. So we see a number of examples where God is able to protect. He was able to protect Daniel in the lion's den. He was able to protect Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in a dramatic way. So God is overseeing the whole thing, and God can protect us, and he can do so anywhere. Look at the land of Goshen. You know, God separated Israel from the Egyptians, and he allowed the plagues to come on the Egyptians, but Israel was spared after the third plague. So God's able to intervene and work out his purpose and to watch over us wherever we may be. We may be scattered out, but God can protect us. But Richard's right. When you look at Revelation chapter 12, it seems to be talking about a specific place. And we'll talk about that more as we go along. So as you look at this place of safety, you know, as the church looked at the particular topic, which is sort of what we're doing, is looking at it historically, where did the church come up with the idea of this place of protection, and then they used that as a basis to come to other conclusions? And actually, that's in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 9. There were various prophecies in Ezekiel chapter 9 that we looked at, and we saw them as applying to the church at the end of the age. And as you, if you remember the layout of the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 8 is a chapter in which God reveals that his people have turned to sun worship. And it condemns them for the sun worship. And they're involved in sun worship in a number of different ways. Idolatry, they're worshiping Tammuz and bowing their head to the sun. And God was very unhappy with that. And then in verse 9, he speaks about something that we're all familiar with. But let's go to Ezekiel chapter 9 and pick up in verse 1. Ezekiel chapter 9, and let's go through verse 1. Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 1. It says, then he called out in my hearing, and so it's God who's doing the calling, in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, let those who have charge over the city draw near with a deadly weapon in his hand. So who is this talking about in Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 1? It's talking about, you know, God is talking to angelic beings, and he has a role and responsibility for them to carry out in going through the city and accomplishing his purpose. So God is speaking of angelic assistants who are going to carry out his purpose. Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 2, it says, and suddenly six men, these are spirit men, the spirit beings that look like men, they're not men. They came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his battle axe in his hand. One man among them was clothed with linen and had a writer's inkhorn at his side. They went in and stood beside the bronze altar. So as you think about, this is it, they're at the temple, and the bronze altar is the altar on which sacrifices were made. It was outside the holy place. It was outside, and that's where they did the, it was the book called also the Brazen Altar, where they would make sacrifices and burn them. So they're by this altar, and here they've got these six angels, and you've got this one angel that was clothed with linen, and he had a writer's inkhorn at his side. Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 3. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub, where it had been, to the threshold of the temple, and he called to the man clothed with linen who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. So we see here that God is instructing these angelic beings, we're not going to spend a lot of time on the inkhorn, the purpose of the inkhorn. It was primarily to set apart those people so that they would not be destroyed, because it goes on to say that go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are within it. So anyway, these people will be marked and they will be spared. And then verse 5, it says, to the others he said in my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eye spare nor have any pity. So they're going to begin killing the people of Jerusalem for their sins. And we've always seen this as an end time prophecy. And why is that? Why do we see this, what's taking place here, as an end time prophecy? Well, the primary reason is Ezekiel is preaching to Israel. And Israel has already gone into captivity. They're no longer in the land. So this has to be talking to Israel, but it's talking to Israel in the future. Israel is, the nation of Israel is gone, and they are living in exile, not knowing that they're Israelites. But later on down the line, then these Israelites will once again come into play. So they're to kill all of the young men and maidens and little children, but spare those upon whom God's mark is placed. And then going on here, as you look at this and you think about who it's talking about, as I said, it's talking about the people of Israel. And it's a little bit confusing exactly who it's talking about. like it can't apply to Ephraim and Manasseh. Does it symbolize modern Israel? I don't think so. And does it symbolize Jerusalem itself? And because and that's doubtful, because look at Jerusalem today. It's ruled by Israel at this point, but it's still a divided city because you have a large Muslim presence there. So God uses the word or name Jerusalem to symbolize a lot of things in the Bible in prophecy. And sometimes he even uses Jerusalem to symbolize the church. And do those who reject sin in this prophecy represent the church of God? Those who oppose sin, are they the church of God because it is the end time? But God doesn't give us details. He doesn't tell us the details of exactly what's being symbolized here. And so given the fact that this is an end time prophecy and righteous people are marked and righteous people are protected, as the church looked at it historically, they saw this as pointing to the church. They saw this as pointing to the church. And it gave the people at that time, the church at that time, a sense of hope that there would be protection for the church at the end of the age. So they looked at what Ezekiel says here. They drew certain conclusions about it, and then they went with that and went on to talk about the place of safety. So the question is there a place of safety? And I think that's already been alluded to, that there is. And it says that and the church is going to be protected. But where is that? Where is the place of safety? Now, as Michelle pointed out, we concluded it was Petra, but we'll see. So anyway, and as was mentioned, when this is talked about is in Revelation chapter 12. So let's go to Revelation chapter 12 and let's look at what it says there beginning in verse 1. Revelation chapter 12, verse 1. So anyway, in verse 1, it says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars." And we have looked at this and seen a woman as a representative of the Church of God in Old Testament times. Because when you look at where it talks about the sun with the moon under her feet and on her head a garland of 12 stars, can you think of any place in the Old Testament where something like that is mentioned? In the book of Genesis specifically. Look at Genesis chapter 37, verse 9. Genesis chapter 37, verse 9. What John was inspired to allude to was the dream that Joseph had. And so Joseph had this dream, and he has the dream, and then he shares it with his family. And his father and his mother and his brothers are not real happy with what he's sharing with them. But as it says here, "Look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bow down to me. Dad, you're the sun. Mom, you're the moon. And the 11 stars are my brothers." And his brothers already didn't like him. And so telling them of this dream, that just infuriated them more. So he told it to his fathers and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" So they were not happy with his dream, but that doesn't change it from being a reality. And as you look at John writing the book of Revelation, he goes back to this because it's important to the Old Testament people of Israel. And the Old Testament people of Israel tie in with the New Testament Israel that we know is the church. And then it says in Revelation chapter 12, verse 2, Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And so as John cites this about this woman being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And what's that talking about? Well, it's talking about the coming of Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And Jesus Christ was born in Judah, which is a nation of Israel, one of the tribes of Israel. Chapter 12, verse 3. It says, and behold, and another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having seven heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his head. So then another figure is introduced here in verse 3, a great fiery red dragon, which we know to be Satan. And it talks about 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. And Satan is very influential in this realm with these people. It says then it goes on to say in verse 4, his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. So Satan drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. And as we look at the scriptures historically, we know Satan was there at the seeking to destroy Christ right from the very beginning. And verse 5, she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. And as you look at what John is describing here, he's describing Satan and his influence and the demons. And then he's talking about Jesus Christ. There's no debate about this being that was born to the woman who was Jesus Christ. And as you look at the woman, she was physical Israel, and she was also the church. Physical Israel and the church. And as you look at what's taking place here from verse 1, going all the way back to Genesis chapter 37, and all the way even before that, where it's talking about Satan and his rebellion against God, you're having this crunching together of all these events that took place, and just giving you the highlights of what took place over a fairly large span of time, going all the way down to the time when the church was established. And so we see from Satan's rebellion, when his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven, and this took place before Adam and Eve were ever born.
Here's a question I got to do. Rich has his hands up. Was that from before, or does Rich want to say something?
I don't know. Ask. Rich, do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I think it's really interesting you pointed out about Joseph's dream, and where Jacob said, "Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down before the ground?" Well, that's where God really shows us that we know the truth, because Jacob knew the truth. There will be a resurrection. His mother was dead at that time. So he was talking about the future.
Yeah, interesting. So anyway, as you look at what you find in Revelation 12 verses 1 through 5, it's talking about these events, some in the ancient past and some that are to play out in the future. And then it says in Revelation chapter 12 verse 6, it says, then the woman fled into the wilderness. So this woman fled into the wilderness. We know the woman is the church, fled into the wilderness. You know, as you look at the woman that was ancient Israel, she went into the wilderness, didn't she? And then the true church fled into the wilderness, where she is has a place prepared by God that they should feed her their 1,260 days. So as you look at, she fled into the wilderness. Now the question is, if this is the church, why did she flee into the wilderness? Why did she flee into the wilderness? Well, we've always felt, and why that period of time, 1,260 days. And as I said, we're talking about the church here. And you can see the symbolism changes from ancient Israel, and then it's talking about this woman who fled into the wilderness. And, you know, Israel always had didn't have to flee. They were led by God and they were spared and they were in the wilderness for 40 years. But this 1,260 days, it's talking about something that took place with the church. And we've always understood it to mean that the church began to be persecuted, and the persecution really kicked into high gear in about the year 325. So the church was in basically the wilderness for 1260 years. The church was in hiding because they were being persecuted, they were being pursued, and they had to be very careful about being Christians and professing their Christianity, because there were persecutors out there who were more than willing to burn them at the stake, or take their property, or whatever that they felt needed to be done. So they were in the wilderness for 1260 years, and it's interesting, as you look at that time period, the church continued to exist, but it was a hard time to be a church member. And the burden of being a church member only ended as the God intervened to loosen the hold of the Catholic Church on religion in the Western world. So God caused the Protestant Reformation. God allowed it to take place, and then the people of God were more free, little by little, to continue to worship God and to do so more openly. We have all lived in a time where we can worship God openly. Nobody's confiscated our homes. They've not threatened us. We've, we receive some persecution, but comparatively speaking, none of us have had to give our lives, at least in the Western world. Maybe some have suffered that in other parts of the world, but that's not been the case. Now, as you look at what's taking place here with verses 1 through 5, it talks about Satan leading the demons against God. And then it says that in verse 7, and war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So as you look in my New King James Bible, there's a heading here before you get to verse 7. And the heading says Satan thrown out of heaven. So up to this point where he's thrown out of heaven, Satan can go before God. But there comes a point where God said, sorry, you're done. And he speaks of this, and Satan realized that he doesn't have much time. And so he leads another rebellion against God. So we know that one of these rebellions took place back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It talks about the results of that rebellion. And in Isaiah and Ezekiel, it speaks of his rising against God and seeking to take the throne. And Satan is going to once again lead a rebellion against God. God's going to cast him out, and they're going to seek to overthrow God, and like it says here, they won't prevail. Nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So they're going to fail in their goal of taking over heaven, and they're going to be cast out, and they're not going to be able to come before God's throne from that point forward. So we're going to go through the rest of Revelation chapter 12 next week, and we will finish and give you some things to think about, and we'll look at what was talked about as far as her place, and about why some people are suffer and don't go to the place of safety, and some other things to think about. And I think what's happened is we have not fully, I think we've maybe gone too far with some of the things that we believed as far as the church is concerned, and the place of safety. And I think you'll be able to see that next time as we go through the subject.